Hello and welcome to another episode of Living with Dying. Today I'm very happy to meet Jenny McDonough, who has something in common with me, really, because she lost her husband 2 years ago and he had a journey from hospital to hospice, much as my husband did. And they both ended up in the same hospice, and we're here in the Thames Hospice today to record the interview. So Jenny, thanks so much for coming and sharing your experience with me. Would you like to tell me what happened to your husband?
Such a pleasure to do this, Dylan, especially at Thames Hospice. My husband was this amazing, strong workaholic, wonderful dad, wonderful husband, who got prostate cancer. And what we didn't know at the time and found out at post-mortem was he had this little cell growing, doing its own thing within his prostate. He had hormone treatment, which he probably shouldn't have had, because if he'd known about this other little cell, it probably helped it grow. But anyway, he had hormone treatment and he had radiotherapy. And during the radiotherapy, believe it or not, he carried on working all the time. He was going every day to Guildford for his radiotherapy. And we carried on working. We were getting Emily's Escape, which is a holiday home for children with cancer. We were doing that. We had a major leak, and he was ladders and goodness knows what. And a couple of months later, he was going downhill. And my daughter-in-law, who's a doctor, looked at him and said, well, I don't like his, he's got a very puffy face. And anyway, we went to the GP, and the GP took blood tests, as they always do, and found that his platelets were low, and sent us directly off to hospital. And they sort of scratched their head and admitted him for a few days, and then threw him out again. And then he kept going backwards and forwards for about 5 weeks, I suppose it was. And nobody could decide what was going on. They just couldn't decide. And in the last 2 weeks, we were there, and we were saying, look, he's going downhill. And I can remember saying to one of the doctors, you know, this could happen to you. You're looking at somebody who's perfectly strong going downhill in front of your eyes. It was absolutely in plain sight, this wonderful man. When we first were admitted there, we used to have meetings outside by reception, do all the emails for the business, and he'd make his business calls, and you know, and that was probably, oh, I don't know, 2 weeks into, so 3 weeks before he died. It's very sketchy now. I mean, the one thing about grief, it has that sort of thing. It blocks out bits of information, and then it comes back and hits you with another bit of information. You think, well, was that right? But anyway, this is a sort of sketchy, it was within his 5 weeks. And my daughter-in-law, who the doctor, she cancelled all her appointments and was with me. She's a consultant psychiatrist, well, a nearly less consultant psychiatrist. And bless her, she was there for every doctor's meeting, everything. And she kept saying, look at him. He's failing. And they scanned him to within an inch of his blood tests, because I don't know what it is about the NHS. They feel that if they do blood tests, they're doing something, and the family are happy because you're doing a blood test, you know, we're doing something. But of course, it's not true. They're not doing anything. Anyway, this carried on, and I still thought he was going to come home with me. And it must have been about 2 weeks. One of the junior doctors said, do you want to sign, given what we know now, would you like to sign a DNR, a do not resuscitate? Mm-hmm. And my daughter-in-law, quick as a flash, turned around and said, well, actually, what do we know? And she walked away, this junior doctor. Mm-hmm. Walked away. That was just one of the experiences we had. But we had many. I could write a book on the experiences we had during that 5 weeks.
So did you learn anything after that?
No. Anyway, it continued. And then that was 2 weeks. And then a week before he died, on the Monday, they put him into palliative. NHS can't do palliative. They haven't got a clue. And if there's one thing I could do when I was younger, that's what I would focus on, trying to withdraw all the palliative from the NHS, put it into hospice care, and leave the NHS to do what they're supposed to do, acute care, operations, sort everybody out, be cheaper in the long run. You know, I could sort it out. I know exactly what I would do. Anyway, put in the palliative, so-called, on the Monday. But I didn't realise that you continue to take blood tests when you're in palliative. And on the Wednesday, a new team appeared. And apparently every time a new team appears, you have to have more blood tests. And on the Wednesday, he had a blood test, and they couldn't find, all his veins had shot down. So, hey, let's take it out of an artery. So we ended up with a pool of blood on the floor, a vagal in the container. Anyway, that was the Wednesday. And on the Thursday, magic. I arrived at 7:30 in the morning, because he can't stay overnight, and even though he's in palliative. And he wasn't there. He wasn't in his room. I mean, he wasn't in a room. He wasn't in the ward.
Gosh.
And somebody, I had no idea what was happening. Somebody in the ward said he's been taken to a side room. And I went to the nurse's station. I said, can you tell me where my husband is? Yes, it's in that room there. And he was in this bleak, grim, awful cupboard of a room. There wasn't a picture. There was nothing. It was just horrendous. And the nurse turned around to me and said, oh, don't worry, he's been moved to hospice today.
Oh.
And I said, well, I'm sorry, but that's the first I've heard of it. And it would have been really nice if you could have phoned me to tell me you moved him into this cupboard so I could have come and sat with him. I didn't know at that time that he was going to be moved to the hospice that day, but I was hopeful that that's where he would go. I mean, I couldn't conceive him dying in that cupboard. I really could not.
And by then, had they made it clear to you that he was dying?
Yeah, I mean, it was quite visible. It was quite visible. I suppose, if I'm honest, I could never be honest myself, because I always thought I was going to take him home. You know, always. You know, I still can't believe he's dead. I cannot believe he's not here. This wonderful, vibrant, fit man. Anyway, I go off the piece, I do this. So, I said, do you think he could have some pain relief? No, don't worry about pain relief. He'll get it at the hospice, they'll sort it out. I said, yeah, but he's in pain. And I said to the sister on the ward, I said, look, you know, he's going to be moved. They've got to get him from that bed onto a trolley to take him to an ambulance. Please give him some pain relief. And reluctantly, she sort of huffed and hawed. And she said, well, yeah, okay, we'll sort that out. And then the worst thing anybody can do to anybody in my situation or anybody else, she put her arm around me and she said, you've got to stay positive. And I said, what have I got to be positive about? He's going to die. I mean, I hate the word positive. Absolutely hate it. Be optimistic. Be hopeful. But positivity, no, I don't do positivity. She walked away. Thought, well, you know, I'm a lost cause. I don't bother with her anymore. So anyway, the ambulance came and he was in terrible pain because I don't think, you know, obviously they hadn't given him it early enough to get grip of it. And he was screaming, and Nick never, I mean, he could cut his arm off and he wouldn't cry. You know, he was so tough. So he must have been in dreadful pain. And I sat with him and arrived over here after a horrendous journey, because I got bumps all the way along the road. Traffic calming, they call it. Ambulance nightmare, I call it. Anyway, we got here, and it was a day like today. It was sunny and warm and beautiful. And when you arrive at the ambulance bay and you look up, you know that's the end. All of a sudden, that is the end of your... It's the beginning of your end of your story. Anyway, we were met, and all of a sudden, you feel really safe. That was the first thing I felt. I knew Nick would be safe. Whatever his journey was, I knew he was safe. This place is so wonderful, staffed by angels. Just wonderful.
So the minute you arrived, you felt different?
Yes, yeah.
Do you think he did?
I don't know what he was aware of. That's the problem. I hope he did. I hope he felt safe. I mean, we had talked about dying quite loosely. He wasn't a great one talking about death, whereas I'm quite, you know, I will talk about it. It was me who said, come on, ages ago, come on, let's update our wills. We don't need to do that now. I said, yes, we do. Let's update our wills. Yeah, I think he did feel safe, and I definitely felt safe. And we were taken to this beautiful room. I waited outside. They settled Nick into his bed, and I went back in, and I didn't really leave him then. Then the friends all arrived. All the way through, he'd seen all our friends pitch up on a regular basis. They'd almost worked it out how one person was going to be there nearly all the time, which suited me, really, going forward, not to start with, but in the last couple of weeks, there was always somebody there. And it's quite nice because, you know, he'd rest and I would get coffee or whatever. But anyway, but once we got here, it was different. The vibe is so different. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. And I would urge anybody who has a chance to go into a hospice and use the coffee shop, go and get a feel for it, because it's not frightening. If you come here to the cafe by the lake, the staff are lovely, everybody's nice. Go into reception, toodle off and have a lovely coffee, or I mean, I drink too much hot chocolate here. Have lunch, sit by the lake, bring friends, have a business meeting. I've done the whole shebang here, really. I've done all sorts of things. But it supports them. I spend my time explaining what hospice does. We both know that you just don't go to hospice to die. That's a side event right in the future. You go for updating your pain relief, go to one of the classes, have some therapy. But unless you go and have a look, you don't know. But I mean, death is right. I mean, it's top priority, but low priority. You know, I have this feeling that if you have a good life, you deserve a good death. If you've been good all your life, and he was just, oh, great. But what I'm saying is that, you know, he deserved a good death. He really deserved a good death. And I think we all do, actually.
But once you were here,
yeah,
you felt he got a good death.
Definitely. Definitely. I'll always remember it. I will always remember it. It was on a Saturday morning, so he came in on the Thursday. And he died on the Saturday following. And I obviously slept overnight. They have these wonderful pull-out sofa things. They make the bed up for you. Oh, it's fabulous. Oh, good Lord. I must just go back a bit on that, because the family had been with him, and they were always there, Nick and Jamie and my two sons and my daughter-in-laws. And somebody poked their head round the door and said, "Can I get you a drink?" We said, "Oh, no, you know, we have plenty of tea and coffee, thanks." Oh, this was the day before, actually. "No, no, not that sort of drink. A drink. So he was giving me my glass of red, and, you know, it was so sweet, you know. And that was the day before, so that would be on Thursday night. Yeah, that's right. Saturday, you know, I think Dr. Nick had been in and the day before and said, "You know, it's not going to be that long, Jenny, really." And he wasn't on, that Dr. Nick wasn't on the day he died, but another lovely doctor was on. And all the friends came in again, and they came and they were with the family until about, I don't know, about 11, half past 11 that morning. And the rest of the family, my son stayed, and one of his sisters stayed, and the daughter-in-laws, and the grandchildren popped in to say their goodbyes, which was really nice, the older grandchildren. And then they left, and it was just the immediate family. The sun was shining, it was just beautiful, and cuddled up with him. And I've seen death before, and I know what happens. And I could see, you know, he was gonna slip away. And he had the most peaceful death. Just stopped breathing, and he'd gone. The curtains fluttered, and I am absolutely, to this day, convinced that was his spirit leaving the room. And I'll always believe that. It was just, for me, it was a blissful thing to see happening. And I just always remember it. Just those curtains fluttering, and the sun was shining. It was a perfect day, because he loved being outside. He was always, any moment of the day, you know, he could be outside, loved being outside. Just perfect. And then, you know, kind of everything started happening. I think when somebody dies, it's just, I don't know. It was just such a shock. I mean, I knew he was going to die, but it was such a terrible shock. Do you find that, Dulles? The shock.
Well, I had, similar to you, I had 3 weeks build up to it. Mm. But yes, you still think you're taking him home.
Yes. You do. You can't help it. I don't know whether that's a sort of safety mechanism, keep you sort of sane during that period, or what it is, but...
It's final, too. I mean, it's the finality of, it's like a chopping off in a way, isn't it? That bit of your life has gone.
Yeah.
As well as your husband's gone. So much to come to terms with. It's not surprising. Grief sort of takes over and puts you into a fog.
Grief is absolutely horrendous. Unless you've been there, you know, I mean, obviously my parents have both died, and that was awful, especially my mum. But no grief is like this.
Well, it is your other half, isn't it, that's
totally
gone? And
took,
it feels like
you've
been cut in half, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think he took it with him. I'm still searching for that half. There's no, I will never be complete again, because he did take that half of me. And how much you try and start to reinvent yourself and try and find this new life, I think it's terribly difficult.
It's not necessarily the one you want, is it?
It's not the one I want at all. Absolutely not.
Can I just ask you about something? Because you mentioned the pain that he was in the hospital. Mm. Did the pain go the minute you got here? Did they manage it well that he
pretty
was
pain-free? Much. Yes.
That's brilliant, isn't it?
That's what they do. That's exactly what they do. You know, they've got years and years of training and experience. You know, good grief. You know, if in the NHS, and I'm not going to name the hospital, but in the NHS, if they don't know what to do, they either bury themselves in their iPad or they walk on past. When they visit a patient, and this is from the consultants down, we saw every single consultant imaginable on Nick. And they all had one thing in common. They didn't look at the patient. They look at the iPad and the records and what had gone before. And it's always, you always have to say this, tell them the same story, and it's all written down and you're looking at it anyway. So why don't you just read what's there and move on? Because you're not looking at the patient. And every time we said to them, look, he's falling off a cliff, they couldn't possibly know what we mean because they didn't look at him. You know, every day they need to look at him. And you know, I kind of think it's almost like being quite shifty, you know, if you're doing something you shouldn't be doing, you don't look directly at the person. And I think they were like rabbits trapped in the headlights. They didn't know what to do with him.
And they didn't want to tell you that?
I don't know, don't think they knew what to do. I honestly, they always thought, I don't know what it is. I think they've got this mantra, do no harm, and I get that. But they got to know when to let go. And probably that junior doctor who said, do you want to sign the DNR? It was clumsy. It should have been much better to have taken us to one side and said, look, we don't know what's going on here. You know, it's time we thought about moving him into hospice care or something, or send him home or whatever. You see, my other daughter-in-law is an occupational therapist, and that's what she specialises. She specialises in the elderly, of getting them out of the cottage hospital type thing in Wokingham, and then she gets them out of there into home, back home, or to a long-term nursing home. That is what she does. So she would have got him home, but they wouldn't let him go. They didn't tell us. No, we booked him in for a scan day after tomorrow. He's got an ultrasound, he's got an MRI, he's got a this, he's got a that. Why? He's had hundreds of them. Hundreds of them. There's a special name. When you do the tests for prostate or any screening, there's a special thing there, and I never can remember it. I always want to say paint, but it's not paint. But if they'd have done that when he was diagnosed, they'd have found it. And that was the difference. They didn't do it because it's not protocol. And that's the other thing about the NHS. It's stuck in protocol. You know, if the book says this, this is the way we do it. Well, that's got to change.
So did you never find out what he died of?
Yeah, we did. He had a post-mortem.
After the post-mortem, not until then.
Rachel, bless her, was absolutely insistent that he had a post-mortem. And she was right. I don't think, because of what it was quite aggressive, I don't think he'd have made old bones, but he'd been with us long enough to say goodbye. He would have been long enough to sort out the business side of things. We've, you know, it's been really trying. Although I'm part of the business, it was trying to shuffle the cards, really.
So what you're saying is if he'd had that stain test while he was in hospital, then he might have had longer.
I think if he'd had the stain test when he was diagnosed,
they would have found out what was wrong.
Yes.
They would have known how to treat.
Totally, when he was diagnosed, first off, 2 years before he died, and perhaps his treatment would have been better. I can remember when we went and saw the consultant when he was originally diagnosed. A lovely guy, really, really nice. I went to bits, Nick was stoical. My daughter-in-law was with us. And he said, Jenny, don't worry about it. It'll be fine. We've got hundreds of treatments for prostate cancer. He'll be fine. And every bit of his treatment, he did so well. He didn't have any problems with any of it. You know, he was fit, well, nothing changed. But it's a small percentage of men that get this, but they still get it. I think it was something like 2%. And I think 2% doesn't sound very much, but 2% of families that grieve, it's a lot. And also, if we'd have known, our preparation would be different. He'd never, in those last weeks, he wouldn't have gone to hospital, he'd have gone to hospice. He'd have had the joy of being in the hospice, lovely food, lovely ambience, lovely people, da 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 da. He wouldn't have been in a horrible hospital.
Now, what we haven't talked about so far is your amazing fundraising for the hospice and also Emily's house, which you've mentioned your granddaughter, Emily. Can we talk about both of those? Because let's start with your fundraising for the hospice, because that's amazing.
The fundraising for the hospice. When Nick died, I went to hospice website and I saw this skydive. And I thought, I can do that. I was going to do it for young lives with cancer, but because of COVID and everything, I didn't do it. But then I saw this, and I thought, I can do that, because I don't care if I die. If I jump out of the plane and I'm dead, that's it, that's fine. Anyway, so I signed up for that, and I think I probably raised about £3,000 on that. And I had this gorgeous guy to do it with. My goodness, was he gorgeous, my cohort. It was lovely. That I did that. And my daughter-in-law, bless her, had the champagne on ice in the back of the car. She's very posy. Bless her, she's great. Anyway, so that was that. But now I'm doing this walk. Now, this is really hard because we did the walk together for Young Lives with Cancer. Started off during COVID and carried on. And we raised a lot of money. I think it must have been getting on £14,000 for Young Lives with Cancer. And we had TV exposure, and Radio Berkshire heard us first, and the producer for BBC Breakfast heard that and said, I want them on my programmes, da, da, da. And it's sort of snowball effect, so we did all of that. And people were watching BBC Breakfast saying, I know those. And it's really quite crazy, it's really funny. I'm doing it, and that was, it started off because they had this thing, walking to the North Pole to see Santa. And we said, well, we can't do that, but we walked to Northumberland. So we started off by walking to Northumberland because that's got the clearest night sky I can't think what it's called. Anyway, so it's got the clearest night sky. So we walked there, but it's only virtual because it's during lockdown, so you're walking virtually. So we were actually walking outside. We were only supposed to do 30 minutes a day, but of course we didn't, and we didn't see anybody anyway, so we thought we're not doing any harm, so we'll keep walking, and if we get arrested, hey, we get arrested, but we didn't. So we kept walking, and we ended up with, I think, something like, was it between 12 and 14,000, 1,400 miles. And my son said to me, you do realise that's as far as walking to Florence. Well, we loved Italy, really loved Italy, so loved it. So anyway, so that's how loosely it became, that now I am walking back from Florence on my own on this spiritual journey without Nick. It is the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. Hardest bar none. I started off doing it. I got the idea because it's always my go-to. I have to walk. If I'm stressed, if I'm upset, if I'm da-da-da-da-da, whatever, I have to walk. So I was walking and I suddenly thought, well, you know, I might as well use this walking for the hospice. Hey, easy.
So when you say virtual walking, you're doing so many miles a day.
Yeah, every day. I have it on my phone.
Right.
So I put my phone on and I do, sometimes I do 8 miles, but I have to do, I have now, I'm broken the back of it now. So I need to do 4 miles a day. Because I did so much in the start, my feet are absolute, bear witness to the fact that I've walked a lot. Anyway, so that's how I do it. During COVID, I used to do some of it on the treadmill. We walked a lot, but we walked. My goodness, did we walk. And it's a lifesaver, actually, because we were so worried. Emily, bless her, had been diagnosed just before COVID. She was diagnosed. She was 5 weeks old. She was diagnosed in the November, and COVID lockdown was in the March. And Jamie, my son, this was their first baby. He didn't know one end of a nappy from the other. He was locked in a room in Southampton Hospital with this baby going through treatment. And she spent the first nearly 7 months of her life there. And now she is 6. We don't know how she is, really. But she's wonderful. She started school. She's 6 now. And she obviously couldn't go to nursery or anything, but they let her go to school now. And she goes to school with her little brother, Rufus, who's going to be 5 in it next month. And yeah, she's doing really well. She's full of everything. Full of everything. Beautiful. So that's her. Emily's escape was born out of that. We decided we wanted to have a single home that would cater for families on their own. They book through their social worker and they come down from wherever. You know, we've had them from Alder Hey, we have them from Gosh, we have them from all over the place. And some of them are very poorly kids. They have to be in treatment for cancer or a year post-treatment or bereaved. That's our cohort, because you know, we can't take everybody. And every other week from April to the end of September, that's what we do. And it's great because we're near Legoland, Thorpe Park, Peppa Pig World, you name it.
So basically you have a house.
We
and
have
you're
a house.
Letting these people come and
yes.
use it for nothing.
Yeah, I meet them when they arrive just to say hi. We give them a welcome pack with a bottle of wine and all that stuff. I make the beds, change the beds with my daughter-in-law. My daughter-in-law's great. She comes and does a lot of the cleaning because she's a really good cleaner. And so everything is immaculate when the next people come in. And we've got a gardener who does the garden, got a lovely garden. And yeah, it's such a thrill.
It's a wonderful facility.
It's just such a thrill. I get more out of it than anybody else. It's such a thrill. So I meet them and then they just leave the key in the drop box after. So I don't see them when they go. And everybody respects the house and they leave it beautifully.
And I bet you get some lovely feedback.
Yes, well, we've got a visitor's book. So they do that and then we got lots of letters. And they all the children and the parents as well, paint stones. So we've got a hope trail up the garden with all the stones and the messages. And they take a Polaroid snap. So all along the fireplace, because I've got to find something to do with these photographs, there were photographs of the children that stayed there. So yeah, it's brilliant. And we've got 3 different rooms. We've got the Lego room, which is all done out in Lego, Lego duvet, Lego this, Lego that. And then we've got the Windsor room, which is all Union Jacks and all that stuff. And that's the twin room, which is really nice. So it's a single Lego room, but it's also got a cot in there. And then we've got the twin room. And then we've got the, what do we call it, the other room? That's the Windsor room, that's right, the other. And then we've got a room for the parents, which is a country room, so it's all countryside, and it's lovely. I go in there sometimes, and I'd just like to climb into that bed and go to sleep. But do you know, it's bizarre, but the joy of giving, you know, it's never a truer word. It's better to give than receive. And that is so true. You know, I don't know what I would do if I didn't do what I do. I love it. I love it. So, yeah, I mean, I'd rather not be here. I'd rather not have Emily's escape. I wish every child was cured of cancer, that there was no reason to have Emily's escape. But we've got to do it. It's there. I've got to deal with it. I've got to deal with the fact that Nick died. And this is the only way I personally know how to deal with it. And that's why you do what you're doing. Only way you know how to deal with it.
But you seem to do so much. I'm in awe of you. You have all these different strings to your bow and you're pushing on, aren't you?
Yeah, got no choice. No choice, Dennis. You know, you either go into a corner and die, or you pick yourself up and say, I'm going to get out of bed and I'm going to get going. And that is a hard challenge in life. I mean, grief is not easy. Not easy at any level. But losing your other half is just... It's up there. And it can destroy you if you're not careful. And I know that Nick would not want me to be any other way than I am. He would want Emily's escape because that was his dream. He'd want that to blossom going forward. So I hope it just goes forward, and I hope this hospice survives whatever is thrown at it. And it's really challenging. I know it's challenging for them. So anything anybody can do to just, any hospice, I mean, far and wide, support your local hospice because it is a challenge. And you don't know whether you're going to need them. And people, you're right, people don't like talking about the hospice, and they should. They should.
Well, you're helping people do that, aren't you? So thank you so much, Jenny, for sharing all that and your enthusiasm with me. I'm very grateful.
That was a pleasure.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.